This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
What a polite way of saying that I come to this with a very sparse knowledge base. Except for one thing. I spent 35 years covering American politics. No one on this panel has had more exposure to gaseous emissions than I have. Should also give a shout out to the New York Times for a terrific way to publicize this. This may seem like an arcane subject, but as you know and as you've seen, this whole issue has become a major source of contention. And today, on page one of the New York Times, we learned that the Obama administration is looking toward this potential bonanza in natural gas in geopolitical terms, that it's seen as a potential weapon against Vladimir Putin's effort to intimidate Ukraine, Poland, some of the Eastern European nations with their supply of natural gas. And on the other hand, those of you who have seen a few years ago the Academy Award-nominated Gasland know that for some people, hydraulic fracking is an existential threat to the environment. One more point about energy. It supplies heat and light. It is our goal tonight to offer you more of the latter and less of the former. Nancy Fund, who is the founder and managing, over here, and managing partner of DBL Investors, I think it's fair to say that their effort is renewable, sustainable energy. Had she not flown here, she would have driven here in her Tesla, because she was involved with that company and remains involved, just to let you know where she's coming from. Marcia McNutt is the editor-in-chief of Science Magazine and is, I hope, going to be our go-to person on what does the research tell us. She's also the former director of the U.S. Geological Survey and was involved with an event that some of you may know about, the Deepwater Horizon spill. So to say that she has had hands-on experience is an understatement. Tupper Hull, on the far left, let's not make political jokes, they're too easy, is the senior, he's a vice president for strategic communication of the Western States Petroleum Association, comes to that from a background that has included journalism. And Stephen Hamburg is the chief scientist of the Environmental Defense Fund, who supplied one of the clips that we saw. Tupper, you profess bafflement at the controversy. Why?
Well, what I really said was, for the folks that are the petroleum engineers, the people whose job is to go out and find and bring oil and other energy products to the marketplace, this is a baffling issue for them. Because for them, the technology that we're talking about isn't terribly exotic. It's a pretty well-known and technology that's been used for quite a while. And it's for the engineer's point of view, a question of risk assessment and risk management, that there are known risks. This is an industrial process that involves high pressures and a lot of equipment and machinery, and clearly there are enormous amounts of regulation now that govern these activities. And in my experience and my viewpoint here is very much colored by California, where we operate. And on the other side here in the state, we have a point of view that has really become kind of the conventional wisdom among a lot of the environmental groups, that this is a technology so inherently dangerous that it cannot be regulated, that it has to be prohibited. And that's a chasm that really seems very baffling to people.
As the vice president of the Environmental Defense Fund, do you see fracking as a process so dangerous that it cannot be regulated and therefore must be stopped?
No, I think Michael Bruhn said it quite well from the Sierra Club, that you've got a tension that you've got to resolve. So you've got to use natural gas because it's to the degree necessary to get to renewables, because it's the lowest carbon fossil fuel out there, but you've got to get it right, because you can't afford the kinds of downside incidents that you're seeing in many of these videos. We really have to get the rules right. We have to regulate it. We have to ensure that it's done properly. But at the same time, until we can get all the way to renewables, we've got to get the amount of carbon out of our fossil fuels.
Impacts of fracking, namely landscape modification, and potential for the contamination of water. And I think that the media has perhaps overhyped the problems with water contamination from below ground, whereas I think that there have been cases where spills from above ground have indeed been more likely the problems. And those, I agree with Steve, are probably solvable and simply need to be more caretaken. With a conventional well, one is not using these toxic fracking fluids. So with the conventional well, there is not the problem of the contamination of the water. And in addition, with a conventional well, the hydrocarbons can flow naturally through porous media, whereas with formations that you need to frack, you have to imagine it's more like honey in a honeycomb. The only way to release it is to fracture it so that there's a limit to how far through horizontal drilling one can actually access that honeycomb in order to release the fluids. So the well pads have to be closer together. So there's simply more disturbance of the landscape.
As you look at the landscape, where we are going to be over the next couple of decades, I will not use the term foreseeable future because it's a contradiction in terms. But as you look over the next 20 or 30 years, is there any doubt in your mind that we're going to have to heavily rely on some form of fossil fuel to get our energy?
Oh, I don't think we do. I think it's a bridge technology. I think the costs, anyone that looks at that film sees the costs going up. There's all these people suing, litigation, there's regulation. That's not a curve you invest on. You invest on a curve of, like, solar costs come down 80% in the past 5 years. You want your costs coming down, you want your growth going up, and you don't want a lot of political angst and a lot of messy spills and people saying, oh, it'll be safe forever, because Americans are smart. They don't buy that. They see what... And you know, people love solar. It's personalized. It's something that gives you more independence from your utility, especially as we see storage come online, which is happening as we speak. And, you know, when there's a solar spill, it's just a really sunny day.
Are we going to need a lot of fossil fuel in the next 20 or 30 years?
So I agree and I disagree. So we want to get absolutely as quickly as we can to renewable. But I think if you look at most build-out curves, there's going to be a lot of fossil fuels. If we don't decarbonize that as quickly as we can and every way we can, the amount of accumulated carbon that will be emitted will be affecting everyone in this room and for four or five generations thereafter, because it's the total amount of carbon emitted, and it'll affect you for hundreds of years. So every day you go longer with coal and high carbon fuels, you are putting an enormous burden on future generations.
But we all thought of it. It's not like natural gas doesn't have carbon. And so what people are saying, and actually that's kind of an outdated interview with Michael of the Sierra Club, because they have I just got invited to a lunch next week. They want 100% renewables campaign. So I think we're kind of moving beyond.
My question to Stephen, though, is, okay, is this a question, though, that since what you want to do is reduce it, from your perspective, is a move toward natural gas as a temporary transition a good thing, or are there dangers that you really worry about?
If you think about where we're using fossil fuel and what the viable alternatives and how quickly you can be implemented with real-world problems, what you find is there's going to be a gap that we're using fossil fuels. We have to decarbonize that fossil fuel and absolutely get to renewables as quickly as we can. But we also have to recognize that if we continue to use existing mix, you're adding a tremendous burden, and we can't snap our fingers and get straight to renewable.
Is there some overarching conclusion? Can you say... We have serious problems. We have problems, but they're fixable. It's mostly hysteria, and they're wrong. And then I want to get Tupper your reaction to this.
Science has published in the last few years several papers that have dealt with hydraulic fracturing in a synthesis type format. Most of these papers have dealt with the experience that we've seen in the eastern United States. And so one has to understand that the experience here in California might be a little different. The concern, of course, would be is if you come to a place like California where you actually have seismogenic faults, what will the experience be if you start disposing of wastewater in a place like California?
In California, and I'm well aware, I actually read some of this, and I don't think there's any dispute about the association that they found with the disposal of large amounts of wastewater. And typically what you're talking about is the introduction of a lot of volume of water into a geological formation that didn't have a lot of water there or didn't come from. And that is entirely different in California. Every oil production in California, first of all, our shale resource in California, which is not currently being developed at a terribly high rate, but has the potential to be a very large incremental increase into our oil supply. But oil production in general in California is a process of extracting enormous volumes of water from underground, taking the relatively small amount of oil out of it, and putting that water back into the ground that it came from. So we get, 10 to 15 barrels of water come out of the ground with every barrel of oil. So hydraulic fracturing, then the additional amount of water is de minimis in the volumes that we're talking about of water, the produced water that comes up whether a well is hydraulically fractured or not. So while I think this is one of these issues that smart engineers and geologists are going to need to pay attention, my understanding is it's one of those issues that isn't likely to be present in California were we to see a significant increase in hydraulic fracturing here. Let me just give you a couple of fact points in California, because California is different once again. The amount of hydraulic fracturing in California today is not terribly water intensive. The average amount of water used in a frack job last year in California was about 127,000 gallons. Seems like a lot. It's a little less than half of a Olympic-sized swimming pool. It is not these 5 and 8 and 10 million gallon frack jobs that they're seeing in the Bakken in other areas. So, I mean, and the total amount used for the year was about 320 acre feet. Contrasting that, agriculture uses about 34 million acre feet, industrial and residential is about 9 million, I believe. So the amount of water is not big. What is happening right now, and the drought is certainly accelerating this, there's a tremendous amount of work going on. And how do you take that water that's coming out of the ground? Where it is coming out is produced water, not frack fluids. And how can we reuse that? There's one project that Chevron has in the valley that's producing about 700,000 barrels of treated water a day that it's making use making available for farmers down there. So oil production is both a consumer and a producer of water. And what we want to find is the day when we're a net producer of water for California.
Stephen, let me come back to you. It's a question I may be asking at different times, but I keep thinking that it's at the center of this effort that we're making to throw light and not heat, because I don't think I've asked you specifically. From an Environmental Defense Fund point of view, on the one hand, fracking suggests a massive release of natural gas, which compared to coal and oil is better.
Correct.
On the other hand, there are potential dangers. Are there specific aspects of the hydraulic fracturing process that ought to concern us from an environmental view more than conventional sources of energy? And
well,
what are they?
Yeah, so Marcia mentioned it. So one of the issues is the frack fluids and how you deal with them, and you need to have really strict rules to ensure that you use those. You treat them well, you handle them so that you nothing can be absolutely say you'll never have a problem, but you want to absolutely get the rules so that they'll be minimized to whatever possible that you could. And then you need to make sure that one of the advantages you have now is that you can the technology allows you to have a large number of wells on a single well pad, So then the fragmentation issues that Marcia raised can be minimized. And you want to ensure that you get the casings right and the cement jobs are inspected so that hydraulic fracturing does not bring in an additional burden onto the production relative to other forms of hydrocarbon.
I would like to see the two concerns addressed. One, I'm very happy to hear what Tupper said about the water issue. And I think if I could be convinced that this was not taking water away from other uses, ag, from domestic water use, from wildlife, et cetera, that they were actually using produced water from other operations, that would be good. The other thing that I've learned is that every time, not every time, but very often, there are earthquakes that happen in California on blind thrusts that were never mapped. They were never on any earthquake map, and suddenly there's an earthquake, and we go out later and find, oh, there was a fault, and we didn't even know about it. And so I think it would be very important that there be very good surveys done ahead of time so that in any region that there's fracking done, there's a good survey. Because the one case I know that was documented where fracking itself triggered an earthquake was in the Horn River Basin in British Columbia, and it was a fault that was not known to exist before production was started, and the fracking itself triggered an earthquake on that fault because the fault was not known to be there.
But in any sense, do you see solar power as, is it, from your point of view, is it complementary to what we may be moving into, or is it a competitive thing? Is it a case where the more we develop natural gas, the more you're concerned that we're not going to develop the kind of energy you want to see?
Well, I mean, I think you have to, economics dictates the development of industries. I mean, and when you see a cost curve like solar has, 80% decline in 5 years, you don't see that very often. You have Moore's Law. I mean, California is blessed with, you know, a lot of choices in terms of really great industries, and Moore's Law helped develop Silicon Valley, and these decreases in solar are going to develop, you know, the 21st century energy industry in California. So it really, it's an opportunity cost. It's, I mean, of course, we, you know, if we have some natural gas development, that plays a role. If you look at North Dakota, you know, they don't have a lot of choices there. There are a lot of poor people in North Dakota. They don't have the options that we have in California. And so it doesn't surprise me that that is a place where, you know, people are living in trailers and there's a boom. And in the absence of a federal energy policy, the states are going to take their own action. And that's part of the problem of fracking, is that some states are very lax. We, you know, we've read our history books. We know about all of the accidents and other energy technologies in the past, and why would we think this would be any different? So I think that people are smart. They're recognizing that they'd rather have something that doesn't have that risk, and they can have it for cheaper and cheaper. And when you get storage on it, you can sort of wave goodbye to your utility in a big part of your energy need. And it, I don't know if any of you have noticed, but the dominant investment trend of the past 10 years is mobility and personalization.
How in the next 5 years are you going to wring the maximum amount of carbon out of your actions? That's what the challenge before you. And to do that, we've got 1% solar currently in the United States.
But
and you
growing
have an option,
at a fast clip.
Growing at a fast clip. But I said 5 years. You have some choices before you. And it turns out the biggest way to get the maximum amount of carbon out is you got to get rid of your dirty fossil fuels. And if you can do it to renewables, do it. But most places in this country do not have the capacity, because of natural ability and the grid characteristics, in the next 5 years to do that. The amount of carbon we'll emit in the next 5 years is really going to make a difference for your grandchildren. You got to get it out. And we've got to keep pushing down on that curve. And we're totally in agreement, but you don't lose the opportunity of the short term.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't
benefit.
Do it where you don't need to do it.
Absolutely agreed.
And
absolutely
we're doing agreed. It a lot of places we don't need to do it.
The conversation about hydraulic fracturing really isn't about the safety of hydraulic fracturing. It's a proxy conversation about what we hope, what our aspirations are for the energy future. I think where the oil industry feels very strongly is constraining through public policy the production of energy supplies, setting aside questions of safety and efficacy, but trying to constrain the production of petroleum products on public policy in the hopes that it will accelerate these alternatives. We don't think is a smart policy. We think it causes tremendous disruption in the economy.
It seems to me that when you say put aside the questions of safety, that's a little bit like, apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play?
Right.
I'm serious.
So in California, and we were not supportive of this, but at the last legislative session went through a long process. A lot of bills were introduced and debated. And at the end of that emerged the most stringent regulations on hydraulic fracturing in the country that have all of these new regulations, monitorings, new jurisdictions are now involved in the permitting process, complete disclosures. And so those issues were addressed. And now, you know, we're going to have to figure out as a petroleum industry how to deal with that. Now, what my point is, to try to impose a moratorium on the production within that much more stringent regulatory framework is really about the hope that shutting off petroleum production will in some ways accelerate these alternatives.
My question is, it sounds to me like there's almost a kind of common agreement that, okay, this has to be done right. If it's not done right, there are serious consequences to hydraulic fracking. But from what I've read, the energy industry, when it can, when it has the political power to do so, will resist precisely those regulations.
Any industry in our political process is going to be, there are going to be a number of different advocate points of view arguing, and the process is going to be finding, you know, that path through that people can at least live with. I'm sure the solar industry could find, you know, solar companies don't manufacture the panels very often in California because of the regulations that exist here. And so that process is one, yes, the petroleum industry is going to represent itself. It's going to share its point of view with policymakers. I mean, California had very stringent regulations. We were the leader in the well integrity standards for the country, which is why we believe after 60 years of use, there's never been an incident where hydraulic fracturing has contaminated or impacted groundwater in California.
Footnote, maybe when you saw the 60 Minutes clip, was that clip inaccurate, distorted, fair? What was your take on it?
I saw in the 60 Minutes clip were a bunch of human error, faulty equipment, things that were not related to the process of hydraulic fracturing. And as Mr. McClendon with Chesapeake said, sure, there are going to be accidents. There are companies, unfortunately, and I think part of this whole issue has emerged because we did have a boom in other parts of the country and a lot of players got involved, and some of them weren't as conscientious. They might not have had the experience. And there were accidents, and there were errors, and there were releases that shouldn't have happened. I didn't see anything that fundamentally said the process of hydraulic fracturing was inherently dangerous or too dangerous that it cannot be managed through engineering and regulation.
I want to turn to Marsha, but Nancy, you know, in one sense, I think there's almost a commonality between what you and Tupper are saying.
I was going to say, Tupper, I think you got it right when you said that people view their energy choices in an aspirational way,
right,
and that they surround their vision of the future. They bring that into this debate, and people because of the mainstreaming of renewables, there's more voice to people saying we don't want to dig underground. It just leads to a lot of trouble.
Can I just throw a few facts out there? Every day in California, we consume 44 million gallons of gasoline, about 14 million gallons of diesel fuel, and 11 million gallons of jet fuel. According to the state's Energy Commission, we're the third largest fuel-consuming entity on the face of the earth behind the United States and China. Now, those are essential products that people require, and our industry supplies.
But again, aspirationally, there's a whole bunch of people here that want to stop that. They want to have an electric car that runs off of solar off their rooftop. So, and that's the American dream. That's the California dream, which is
question,
becoming...
And the question is it pleasurable to say that we are anywhere near getting there, say, in the next, 20 to 30 years?
So I'll even say we better get there in the next 20, 30 years, but I want to know what we're going to do between on that road. And so the question is, what can you do as individuals tomorrow? So let's say methane, which comes out of natural gas, it's not just about fractured wells. It's about all of the natural gas supply chain. 60 million houses in the United States depend on it for heat. I live in the Northeast. You know, heat's an important thing there. We don't know how to sort of, it's not very comfortable if you don't have it. So what can you do? Well, we need the regulations to reduce methane emissions right now. We can have the biggest impact on the rate of warming of climate change right now by reducing emissions from existing infrastructure. That's the most powerful thing you can do in the short term, because the rate of warming right now is determined by short-lived climate forcers. The rate of warming right now is determined by that. The most potent one is methane. Methane is natural gas. And we have this large source because we haven't been focusing on it. We don't have the regulations. Colorado just passed a set of rules that will force regulation of all of those emissions, require measurements, et cetera. We need it in all of the country. We need to bring it down. And you can actually most dramatically reduce the short-term rate of climate change. That's a powerful action you can take now.
Well, but you can't take it. I mean, it has to be a democratic process, and Colorado is a leader. I mean, if we're going to frack, we should certainly control the methane. I mean that's sort of a tautology. But the point is, you don't like some of these regulations, and the Sierra Club thinks they're not strong enough. And so there's a lot of paralysis, and a lot's not getting done. And so a lot of people just say, to heck with that. Solar's getting cheaper every day, or wind is getting cheaper every day. I'm going to have storage, so I don't even have to. I can use my solar at night, and I'm going to go that direction.
If I may bring my 1950s Disney World picture of the future that didn't happen. I'm not trying to be flip about this, but I wonder, and then I really want to turn to Marcia and get an overall, whether or not, and I'm struck by the almost commonality here of the aspirational nature of this debate, that it may be much less about the techniques of hydraulic fracking and either the insistence that we need this natural gas for the foreseeable future, that it's going to have an enormous benefit geopolitically, economically, and conversely, the notion that we've had enough of this. We've got to get to... But my question is, I just do not believe that I'm going to be driving a hydrogen car. Maybe my children, certainly my grandchildren, of which there are many, not me, even if I live to a riper, older age.
Well, hydrogen is...
Okay, or a solar... We're not going to have that world... No matter what the policy is, we can move to it, but we're going to, that I'm going to say, this is my, you know, I can be proven wrong.
The growth of, it's 500% growth.
I know 500, but from what to what?
Well,
what's the baseline?
You know,
okay, on the first question, am I aware of an industry study that says we need a lot more regulation? I'm not aware of that. Am I aware of any studies that have come out of, say, environmental groups or NGOs that have compared various energy strategies and said one is better than another, say natural gas is better than coal? Yes.
Okay. Stephen, I wonder to what, if at all, your organization has taken heat, no pun intended, from some of your supporters who said, why are you making this argument? We don't want you making an argument for a transitional fossil fuel. We want you on the side of solar and hydrogen and wind and all. Has there been an issue here, the EDF?
So I want to make clear, we are on the side of solar, wind, and renewables absolutely to max them out, and we have a large program to do that.
Yeah, I get that.
But wait a minute. So you want to do that, and the question is what your strategy is to decarbonize as quickly as possible. That's the question. And, of course, there's a diversity of opinions. How quickly can you get to that, and what are the steps that you do? But to the industry, the Colorado rule was supported by industry. There were a set of leading companies that supported getting rules in place, putting it on themselves to reduce methane. that was not just, we were heavily involved as an environmental organization, but there were industries that said, we got to do this too.
Let me tell you what happens 9 times out of 10 in this, and it doesn't make the newspaper, and it's not conducted in the context of hydraulic fracturing. State of California will come to the industry and say, we need to deal with sulfur in emissions from refineries, and we want to do it this way. And we say, you know, that's going to cost us $3 billion. You think there's another way to do it? We know where we want to get. This is we have an agreement that there's a reasonable level and a need to do it. And then they work together in office buildings in Sacramento or in L.A., and they come up with a set of regulations that it may cost more money to provide the fuel. It may impact some less well-capitalized companies more than others. But they work out a system whereby those regulations come into place. That is what happens 9 times out of 10. Every day, in and out, between any industry, frankly, and government regulators. That's the untold story. And it's happening on hydraulic fracturing right now. We are working through issues on how the new regulations are going to be implemented. It's very controversial. It's very difficult. We have some of our members who are very unhappy, and others are not as unhappy. But that's the process of just going about your business of dealing and regulating.
It's a compromise.
It's all a compromise, and it's about utilizing the knowledge you have because you do it and bringing it to the regulators who sort of are carrying out the wishes of the public they represent. And the two get together and say, we know where you want to get. We think here are some suggestions on a way to get there that aren't unnecessarily disruptive, costly, or harmful to consumers.
The nature of how the arguments about energy, this is a broader question, shift. I was struck when I learned some years ago when nuclear power was being debated that there was a time when the left in the United States was hugely big on nuclear power. I'm talking about the 50s, because they thought it was going to be an incredibly cheap alternative to big oil. No less than Pete Seeger recorded a folk song in praise of nuclear power. And then that turned out, you know, not to be such a cool thing. Even wind turbines have had now a kind of backlash where they're built because some people have felt that it involves despoiling the views. I guess the question is it possible to separate, or should we? I mean, you make an interesting argument, Nancy, that this is a democratic process. But if there is a political force, whether I keep coming back to Texas, where basically the industry writes its own rules. I mean, the separation between the industry and the government in Texas is really not particularly. And then you have a place like New York, where the governor has in effect put a flat moratorium on fracking, and many of his supporters are saying, if you in any way permit this, you know, we're deserting you next year or this year when you're up for election. I mean, is there any sense in which you are optimistic or pessimistic in this area, fracking, that you can separate out the ideological passions from facts?
The one thing I will say is that we have to understand that any choices we make do have impacts. And you mentioned that people talk about wind energy as having viewshed consequences. Frankly, I say get over it. but I think there are bigger consequences that we do have to worry about, both with wind and solar, and that is wildlife impacts. You know, frankly, I think the best place you can put a solar installation is on your own rooftop, because that's a place that's already been impacted, whereas I'm more concerned about when we take pristine, untouched open space that might be available for wildlife and start putting massive solar installations there or massive wind installations that might impact wildlife. But anything we do has consequences, and it is really up to you as the public to become informed about what the impacts are of all of your energy choices and decide what it is that you feel comfortable with. Because all of them have political consequences, all of them have economic consequences, all of them have climate consequences, and you have to understand that. And I think Nancy is right. California is a leader in these, and the choices that California makes do ripple across the country, and it ripples around the world. So, you know, these are things that you need to understand, and I think that they are important for not only you, but for your children and your grandchildren. And we can't change things overnight, but we have to start making choices now, that because we can't wait forever. If we wait too long, then the die will be cast. But we have to move as quickly as possible. Steve's right. We do need a bridge, but the bridge can't be a crutch.
And I think one of the things we have to remember is that we don't assume we have all the knowledge we need to make those informed decisions. So one of the things with respect to natural gas became really clear is that we had a very limited amount of data about what methane was escaping from the system, where it was escaping, and thus how can we fix that. So we're engaged in, I'm personally engaged with more than 100 different collaborators, with dozens of academic universities. We're doing studies. We're doing them on a fast track. They will all be out this year. They're all independent. They're all externally vetted so that we can get the answers and so we can directly work on reducing those emissions so we can directly impact
positive
impacts.
You made an interesting first observation that I wanted to make sure I put out there. The ProPublica, which is a kind of a group of, I don't know, what journalists that work with the New York Times, and they did a study of studies for hydraulic fracking. And the striking thing was the amount of uncertainty. They'd say, well, we found water contamination, but we didn't know what the water was like before the hydraulic fracking began. Well, we found an upsurge in carcinogens, but the level was way below the safety, but we don't know if the level makes sense in the first place. So just to your point, there seems to be an awful lot of
So that's why we're involved. We took the air piece. We couldn't to the all of the parts. We took the air piece, we got the best scientists in the country, and we said, let's solve this problem, let's go do it, and let's not take 10 years, let's take a year, do the studies, and get the best data possible so we can have a really directed, appropriate policy discussion and get the right regulations in place now, not sometime in the future.
That's my question to you, goes back to the reference I made at the outset to the New York Times front page story about the administration looking at this natural gas potential bonanza in geopolitical terms. So I just want to, it's a thought exercise, if you'll forgive me. I mean, I get, as they used to say in my youth, where you're coming from, but if someone posed the following to you, said, look, if we develop shale gas, if we you know, have decent regulations, but we don't put a stop to it, we get this enormous bonanza of natural gas. We become exporters. We become energy independent. We save $100 billion in imports on liquid natural gas. And we become the supplier to Poland, to the former Soviet client states. We undercut Putin and his use of natural gas as a blackmail tool in Ukraine and much of Eastern Europe. And the trade-off's going to be that we're going to develop fracking. In other words, it's a clear cost benefit. We're going to run risks because they're inevitable, right, in any kind of extraction. But we're going to get this benefit that a wholesale move into renewables doesn't get us.
You know, I think that's why politicians have the lowest approval ratings they've ever had, that line of thinking, and that in entrepreneurs are the most popular people on the planet. We are innovators. We solve our ways out of problems. We don't do diplomacy by rushing to some headline on a newspaper.
Thank you.
We used to have negotiations. We had conferences, and now we have, let's just export more natural gas, and that'll solve our problem with Russia. Americans are smarter than that. And again, that's why politicians have low approval ratings.
Well, you might want to.
And the innovation is here. The cost curve is here, and the American public supports renewables.
Germany made the biggest commitment to solar, and they're the biggest importer of Russian gas. So they've made a big down payment. They have made more commitment to renewables than any single country, maybe than Denmark.
But they didn't do it smart.
Now they did it, but they didn't do it smart.
Well, I mean, you know that. Don't you know about feed-in tariffs and the limits of pricing?
I understand.
In the long run, I know that John Maynard Keynes said in the long run we'll all be dead. But in the long run, isn't this fundamentally a losing battle? That is, at some point, we're going to have to move toward much greater, if not exclusive, reliance on renewables than on fossil fuel.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean, our association, as I mentioned, represents major global oil companies. Those companies are major investors in a lot of the renewables and basic research that's taking place. ExxonMobil was responsible for the thin layer technology that made batteries useful in automobiles. There is no question that our association and our members recognize climate change is real, it's man-caused, and that we're going to need to transition to a lower carbon to zero carbon future. The question is only about what is the time frame that we're talking about that occurring, and are we going to do that in a way that doesn't upset, that doesn't harm an unnecessary number of people? And by people, I mean emerging nations that want the stuff that we have and feel entitled to it. You know, I will go back to the U.S. Department of Energy, the Energy Information Administration. Every year they do their energy outlook, and they took into account all of the technology requirements and subsidies and incentives that exist. By 2040, they say the U.S. energy portfolio will be 80% fossil fuel.
If your organization is so convinced that climate change is real and man-made, why does the oil industry give so much money to people like Senator Imhoff, who calls climate change the greatest fraud of the 21st century?
Well, we don't actually give contributions of any type, so I don't know.
I don't mean your association. I mean the industry.
Not general. Everybody is as progressive as WISP is in the Western, on the West Coast.
This could be, you know, this raises a whole interesting future for you that you could.
I may have just ended my career.
No.
With the oil industry.
But I'm giving you a new one. You could be head of the Progressive Petroleum Industry Association and help us get to...
On a serious note on this one. I mean, and I do a lot of these. I understand we play a convenient role in society. We're the bad guys, right? We're the ones who addicted the world to oil. And there's this grand conspiracy that we're all about keeping the world addicted to oil. And, I mean, it's a preposterous notion, but I understand that's the role we play. It's. I think you said earlier, how do we sort of evaluate methods and means by which to make this transition? I would suggest one of them is to set aside that myth and look at the energy industry and see where is it playing and can it play a role so that this transition occurs in a way that is realistic, affordable, and doesn't result in chaos.
I agree with Tepper on that one. I think the oil companies of the future will be energy companies, and oil will be a much smaller piece of what their revenue is based on.
But we are talking, I suspect, we are talking generations.
What is the proof that carbon in the atmosphere is the major cause of atmospheric warming? That is, what about articles in Science and Nature that have pointed to the tilt of the Earth's axis? Is there any doubt that carbon, among the four of you, any doubt that carbon is the major cause of atmospheric warming?
Okay. Well, I'm happy to take that one. There's certainly, this is referring to, of course, the Milankovitch theory that refers to the fact that there's natural climate change in which small variations in incoming solar energy over geologic timescales has caused the ice ages and other climate change. But superimposed on that natural variability is anthropogenic climate change. And the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has looked very closely to tease out how much of the current warming is due to natural climate change and how much of it could be anthropogenic, and has concluded with, what, 90...
Very high percent
confidence that the current warming is due to our release of CO2 into the atmosphere, and it is not due to tilt of the Earth's axis.
And other greenhouse gases.
And other greenhouse gases.
So we have short-lived forcers, and we have CO2 and N2O. So we have two groups, important difference of greenhouse gases, each acting in the atmosphere.
If we do everything, let's say, that the most passionate advocate of renewables wants, and say China and India and Brazil and, I don't know, name your own, Indonesia, don't, does that make any more than a marginal difference?
Well, I think you're asking the question backwards. I think it's, if we don't do it, why would China and India do it? I mean, we have to do it.
If the largest countries in the world don't join this effort, is what we're doing then ultimately doomed to not succeed?
Well, it depends on what your goal is. You can slow the rate.
Okay.
Will it be sufficient to get to a place that we would feel is secure relative to the climate future? No.
Question.
And I was going to say, I just returned from China and had a meeting with Premier Li, and they are rapidly investing in wind and solar and nuclear. They're putting in more nuclear power plants at the most rapid rate.
Did we err by making nuclear power so expensive and difficult that it basically came to a halt?
Well, for one thing, nuclear power has an enormous amount of subsidies. And so the fact that it's expensive and it's still subsidized is why it's not going to grow as a energy source. And I think we're all, as Californians, we see San Onofre go online. You know what? Everyone was panicked. Oh, what are we going to do? San Onofre's online. We can handle it. And there are a lot of plans being made to deal with that. But the nuclear energy industry has one of the biggest benefits you could have that's been written into the Price-Anderson Act in the 60s, which if there's a spill or if there's an accident, the federal government pays much of that cost. And if you look at the congressional record, I don't know if there are historians in the audience, that Price-Anderson, when they wrote that bill, they said, we'll take this away in 10 years because you guys will figure out how to make nuclear safe. That law is still on the books over 50 years later. That tells you something about the ability to have a cost-effective nuclear system.
In California, we're not fracking for natural gas, but oil, which is much more carbon intensive to burn than natural gas. Given that California has the highest population of any state and the highest GDP and the huge risks and climate impacts on unconventional oil production, isn't this a terrible risk? Tupper, is that a fair point that we're talking about a different product here, right?
Well, I mean, there's a reality. If that oil is not produced in California, it's going to arrive here in a tanker from Saudi Arabia or Venezuela or Iraq. We're going to need that energy tomorrow when we get up to go to work. It's going to be utilized here, and so that's the choice that we have today. This is the in for the foreseeable future. So, you know, the question, this is the carbon bomb. You have to leave the stuff in the ground because it has too much carbon and will impact.
If I can just,
and that's really.
But just to be clear,
is
the questioner right that the fact that it's oil rather than natural gas, that has much more serious environmental consequences, right?
I don't believe it has any measurable difference in terms of the technology to get it out of the ground.
No, it's the result. It's the emissions.
Well, but
yes.
Okay, fine. I guess the question is, leaving it in the ground does not mean we're not going to consume the oil. That's, I guess, the question.
Well, we have to remember, and to that there's been many good points.
Right.
If we use that logic, not only shouldn't you have, you just really don't, nobody can have kids, sorry, because then all that carbon will be in the atmosphere and we are cooked. completely cooked. And so we can't take the carbon stores that are in geologic and put them in the atmosphere and expect to have human society of any form that we would recognize. So, I mean, that's not going to work. I think that. So the really question is, how much oil and where does it have to come from? The average new car fleet right now is 22%, is generating 22% less carbon dioxide than it did 5 years ago. That's both the fuel economy and the miles driven, because the miles driven in the U.S. per car, per household is dropping. We got to push that further, harder, fast, to get that consumption curve dropping as quickly as possible.
But what's one thing you absolutely want this audience to know about this area?
I think from a scientific standpoint, science has a lot to offer, but most of the cases where I think that that unconventional development has devolved into one of these he said, she said sorts of situations, like with water quality, a lot of it could have been solved by simply allowing science to do before and after investigations. So I think that, for example, with water quality, I think it's in the best interest of both the consumers and the industry to do baseline analyses of water quality before any drilling is done, so that if anyone has any concerns about their water quality after drilling begins, they have a baseline for knowing what their water quality was beforehand, so that there's no disagreement as to whether the water quality has changed. And the same can be said of things like understanding whether there were faults in the area beforehand, so that there's no discussion of whether there was an earthquake that was triggered because of activity of the unconventional drilling. So just understanding what you had beforehand so that you understand whether there was something that happened because of what was done with the unconventional energy production. Let science do its job beforehand so that afterwards there's no question.
You've got two jobs to do relative to climate and energy. And you got to do them as quickly as you can, but you need to do them both. The first one is you've got to reduce short-lived climate pollutants like methane, black carbon, HFCs, because that's going to determine the rate of climate change in your lifetime. And you've got to get rid of the carbon for all the future generations. And you got to do both of them as quickly as you can, and you've got options for doing it, not tomorrow, starting right now. AB 32 is a great, California's leading the way, but it's not enough. And you got to push as hard as you can to do both those things right away. And I'm completely agree. If we could go tomorrow with all renewable, I'm right with you. But don't let the perfect get in the way of the good if you can't do it. So do as much as you can as quickly as you can on both fronts.
I would tell you guys that we have had the fortune in our own lifetimes to live through innovation cycles, and as a venture capitalist, that's kind of my bread and butter. Innovation is kind of what I invest in, and we've seen we went from the mainframe to the mini to the desktop to the personal computer to the tablet to the iPad. In a very short period of time, we went from terrestrial radio to satellite radio to internet radio. We've gone from rotary phones and analog phones to big cell phones and now smartphones. I mean, on and on. We've all lived. Our lives are much better today because of the innovation that we have been able to bring to the world. Energy has not had that kind of an innovation cycle. And the good news is that it's starting now, and we can innovate our way to a clean energy future, and we can create quality jobs in places across the country that really make our lives better economically, as well as save the planet for generations to come.
I guess what I would like to see is when we have conversations about energy, we need that we can always keep in the back of our minds or put on in the the front of the conversation, that energy and energy policies have real consequences for people. And not everybody has the good fortune to live in Santa Barbara and to attend lovely universities. And energy costs and energy availability are very real issues in day-to-day life. And public policies that are aspirational can have the impact of making the energy that available today harder, more costly, less available. That's true globally, and it's true locally. So I think as when we chart this course forward, we can't forget that there's an awful lot of people who can get left behind and hurt if we believe that higher costs for energy or less available of types of energy people rely on can be reduced. And that has some social benefit because there's tremendous harm that can be done if we don't keep that in mind.
So before we adjourn, deep thanks to Richard Hutton of the Carsey Wolf Center, Stephen Gaines, Wren School, David, you met earlier from the IEEE, and a special shout-out to someone without whom none of this would have happened, Megan Shaw, who was responsible for getting all of us together. I also have to say a special word of appreciation for the fact that so many of you came out on a beautiful weeknight evening to listen to what I think was a genuinely instructive group of a quartet of people who gave us a lot more light than heat. Thank all of you, and thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.